Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I tend to get so focused on the next interview I have to prepare for that if you ask me who I talked to yesterday, it takes me a second to recall it. When I'm reminded of the subject, I can usually recall some details about any given show, sometimes even years later. Of course, there's no way I could tell you offhand exactly when those interviews happened. But a tiny fraction of people do have this level of recall without even really trying. So how do our brains decide what to remember and what to forget? And what can we learn by studying those who are especially good or bad at memory tasks? Filmmaker Annalise Strachan explored these questions in a Nova documentary she wrote and directed. It's called Memory Hackers, and you can see it on KERA television tonight at 8. Annalise, welcome to Think.
Hi.
Early in the film, we meet an 11-year-old boy named Jake, who seems like every other fifth grader in America until you start asking him about his life. Tell us about what he can do.
This kid, Jake, I mean, he is absolutely amazing. And I have to tell you that before I met Jake in person, I couldn't believe that there could be such a kid in existence. And my co-producer and co-director, Michael Bix, and I went down to meet Jake for the first time, just to talk to him for a few hours. And he just blew us away with what he could do. And I just could not believe what this kid could do. You could ask him any date and what he did that day, and he would remember the most uncanny details from that day, just mundane things like, what did you do on, you know, Saturday, October 5th of, 2007? And he would tell you, I went to the dentist and I saw a movie with my mom. And, that day I had a spelling test. And for the things that you could go back and check, I mean, he was always 100% right. And it was just unbelievable.
The actress Mary Lou Henner has similar ability to recall details of her personal life, and she describes it like this.
A lot of the people visualize it sort of in a calendar way, like calendar pages. For me, the closest thing to it is kind of like selected scenes on a DVD. You know when you see that? Okay, so if you name a year, all of a sudden the entire year sort of like lays itself out in chronological order, and each day is a different selected scene, and some of them are more vivid than others, but I can go to each day and it sort of comes up.
Does that track with what Jake told you, Annalise?
It's quite similar, actually, and each of the folks that have this ability described it in a similar way. They had a different visual technique, varying slightly. For Jake, he described it kind of like an iPhone calendar that he could sort of zoom in and see that there were little bullets on different days of different events of significance to him. And he could sort of scroll and zoom in and tell you, you know, what happened to him on that day. It was highly visual. For some of the other HSAM folks we spoke to, the days and the months even had colors or had other kinds of, you know, significance to them. But it was a very visual experience.
What can scientists learn by studying people like Mary Lou Henner and like Jake Hausler? Are their brains different than everybody else's?
You know, that's the big question. I mean, there's no, they don't have a definitive answer quite yet. But the studies that have been done thus far do suggest that they might have some differences in their brains. It seems that certain areas of their brain are larger than ours. But also, the questions that they can answer are not just, you know, can they simply store more memories than the rest of us? But why can't we remember as much as they do. So to look at their brains and try to explain that, I mean, that's what the scientists are really looking for.
I thought it was interesting. You know, in the film, they don't tend to have exceptionally high IQs. They're sort of like everybody else. Is memory related to intelligence?
That is also a really good question. The intelligence is one of those tricky terms. The scientists can't quite agree on a definition of what it truly is. And I can tell you just from my own research in this area, it seems like they are not necessarily connected. While someone like Jake that we spoke to was definitely also a very intelligent kid, I wouldn't be surprised if his IQ was also very high. A lot of the HSAM folks on average, you're right, I mean, they did have average IQs. It doesn't seem that memory in and of itself is key for having high intelligence.
I suppose I can see the benefits to having this kind of recall ability. You know, if you were to lose your phone or your calendar, you wouldn't be sunk. Are there drawbacks, though?
It seems that there are. When we interviewed these HSAM folks, it does seem that, you know, remembering every single trivial detail of every day of your life can have some drawbacks. And Jake was really the one who articulated this well for us. He told us that you can remember all the bad things, you know, just as well as the good things. And that was sometimes, you know, hard for him. And the scientist, Jim McGaw, who studied these people and, in fact, discovered this this ability, told us that it does seem to be somewhat detrimental to be able to remember the bad things equally. That the rest of us, we might just be built this way on purpose. You know, we actually might selectively forget a lot of the bad things to sort of help us function on our day-to-day lives.
Is there any indication that this sort of thing is passed down in families?
Not yet. They don't quite know enough yet to say that for sure. Jake is so far the only one of the only children discovered with this ability. There's a pair of twins, but one twin had it and one did not. And so far, they can't seem to make a connection in families. With Mary Lou Henner, she told us that she suspected, I think, some of her children might have some of the ability, but it's not clear and it hasn't been studied yet.
So this is a tantalizing question. You know, you and I, I'm assuming that you do not have highly selective autobiographical memory. Is that correct?
Not at all. Okay. My memory is terrible.
Okay. Well, you and I could go back probably through this week and remember what we had for breakfast, right? Or
right.
What we wore that day. But it might take a little doing. We had those memories at some point, however fleeting. They weren't just, you know, they weren't gone within seconds. So is it possible that we've all got these memories stored up somewhere, but we just can't access them?
I think that that is, you know, that is a distinct possibility. And that is something that they hope that the HSAM folks will help elucidate for us. It does seem from the biological work that's been done that when you make a memory, there are connections in the brain that are sort of laid down and they do seem to be in there somewhere. And the work suggesting that, you know, once those connections are down there, they may get modified and changed over time, but there are some, you know, residual parts of that memory that may still be there. And, you know, how to access it seems to be what fades over time. So the memory may actually be in there somewhere, but there you may be missing the cue or the right way to get at that information.
I always think it's interesting in brain research in particular that you can learn from people who have extraordinary function and you can learn a lot from people whose brains have been damaged. And you remind us here about this famous patient, really important in medical science, who's gone down in history as the pseudonym HM.
That's right. Yeah, HM probably is the most important patient in all of neuroscience, I think. He taught us some of the most basic and critical ideas that really built a foundation for neuroscience and psychology. He had this, you know, bicycle accident when he was young, and he started having epileptic seizures. And scientists really didn't know what to do, but at the time in the 50s, you know, all they could do was remove the part of the brain. It was the hippocampus that was seemed to be the source of his epilepsy. And when they did that, you know, all of a sudden HM couldn't make new memories at all. He, you know, would have a conversation with you for a couple of minutes and then all of a sudden be, who are you? Where am I? I don't know what's going on. He could tell you his, you know, past life. You know, he could remember his childhood, things like that. But basically anything after the surgery, he couldn't make a single new memory. And that told us that, wow, the hippocampus, this particular structure of the brain, it must be critical for forming new memories. And that in and of itself kind of really set the groundwork to say, hey, you know, there are parts of the brain that do particular things. It's not just the whole brain is involved in everything. There may be some ways of mapping this mysterious thing we call memory. And then the second thing that HM taught us, which is really fascinating, was that he actually did have one particular form of memory still left, and it was unconscious. And this famous experiment done by Brenda Milner helped show us that. He was able to learn how to draw a star using a mirror. And he could do that unconsciously. But if you asked him, you know, what did you just do? I mean, he wouldn't remember. He would never remember having done the task before. But that told us that there were different kinds of memory and that they were in different parts of the brain. And it just so happened that that part of his brain was preserved. So that also gave us a way into exploring memory and saying there might be different forms of memory in different forms of the brain.
It is interesting the way physical memory does seem to differ. You know, there's the old adage that you don't forget how to ride a bike, you don't forget how to swim. There are certain things we learn once and never have to learn again.
That's right. That's right. And that kind of memory is the kind that HM still had preserved, this procedural memory, which is sort of in the back of your brain. There's a particular area that can learn motor skills, like riding a bike, like learning to swim, that, you know, even if you had your hippocampus removed, you might still remember how to do. If you were thrown into a pool or put on a bike, you might actually still be able to do it. And that, you know, that particular kind of memory is separate from, say, emotional memory or your autobiographical memory, your memory for your life or your memory for language. These different kinds of memory seem to be in different parts of the brain. And that's something that's really, really fascinating.
If you give it any thought, all of us are walking around basically built out of our own memories. Mm-hmm. Can we trust what we remember?
I just think that's such a fascinating thing to think about. In researching this show, I mean, that was something, the big question is how much of our memory is actually true? And the more that we spoke to these experts, it just seems the more you can seem to doubt what you think is, you know, your memory for your life, which is sort of scary on the one hand. But then on the other hand, there's research to suggest, like Dan Schachter, who's in our show from Harvard, it seems to suggest that some of the flaws that we think in memory might actually be our friends and might actually be good for us. So the fact that we do, forget, it may be a selective kind of forgetting. The fact that we don't remember events in our life with, you know, total accuracy might actually have a purpose. And that purpose is to be able to, you know, anticipate the future and recombine elements of our past to sort of better solve problems and anticipate things that might happen to us.
So there's maybe an aspect of creativity wrapped up in our sometimes faulty memory.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And of course, it makes sense that, you know, you're unlikely to need to know if you ate a yogurt on Tuesday afternoon, March 12th, 2013, or whatever it might be.
That's right.
Eric Kandel's interest in memory started with a traumatic experience. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Eric Kandel had a wonderful story. He grew up in Vienna as a child, right during Kristallnacht, when the Nazis came and took over. And when he was about 9 years old, he received a toy car from his father. And it was one of his most, you know, cherished memories. And I believe it was 2 days later, the Nazi soldiers stormed into his house and took everything. And it was a traumatic experience for him. And, you know, one of the things they took was his toy car. And, you know, as he grew up, it became this gnawing question for him, is like, how did that memory, you know, become seared into his brain? How did he remember that for life? And it became a lifelong quest for him to find the answer. And he started in psychoanalysis and went to medical school and then ended up kind of following this question into what was a fledgling field at the time of neuroscience and neurobiology.
All right. We'll talk more about that in just a minute with my guest, Annalise Strachan, writer and director of the new Nova documentary, Memory Hackers. You can watch it tonight at 8 on KERA television. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with writer and director Annalise Strachan. Her NOVA documentary, Memory Hackers, airs tonight at 8 on KERA-TV. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Annalise, how did Eric Kandel figure out the mechanism by which lasting memories are formed in animals and ultimately in humans?
Well, as the story goes, he started working with a fascinating creature, a sea slug called Aplysa californica. And this was one of these types of animals that basically no one's ever heard of. And even at the time, you know, people laughed at him that he was going to work on this big idea of memory in such a primitive animal. Thought it was a joke. But he had this seed of an idea, which was actually very profound, that there may be a basic mechanism that underlies memory in, you know, not just mammals, not just, you know, higher organisms, but all the way down to sea slugs. And that basic mechanism might tell us, you know, how memory works, you know, on the cellular level. And what he did was find a type of learning that even that simple animal could do. And in this case, the slug can actually make simple associations, like with a touch and a shock. And he did a famous experiment, teaching a conditioning experiment with this slug, and was able to pin down what happens on the cellular level when that slug makes a memory. And in this case, the slug would learn that a light touch implies a shock and would actually retract its gill, you know, more strongly than if you had just touched it on any other day. And what would happen is that the neurons in the sea slug would actually build new connections to each other to store that memory.
Because it doesn't want to get a shock.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, that would, conversely, it could also store memories by eliminating those connections. And you would see, like, it had to unlearn that experience, for example. He could reverse it. And so what Kandel discovered was that the changing of connections, even in the simple mind of a sea slug, is what builds a memory.
So the formation of memories changes the structure of the brain?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's the big idea that he discovered, was that the changing structure of the cells in your brain is what stores a memory.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go now on the phone to Charlie in Caddo Mills. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I got one question. Are old memories affected every time you remember them by current events going on around you, what you've recent memories?
It's an excellent question. And that kind of gets into this idea of reconsolidation, which is sort of a fairly new area of research in memory. And yeah, the research seems to suggest that when you bring up a memory, when you're thinking about a memory, there is a chance that you may be changing it. And whether that affects old memories as much as recent ones is still an open debate, especially in humans. But it does seem to be the case that in animals, at least, that when you recall a memory, it's vulnerable to change.
Why are we more likely to remember first experiences or unique experiences than those that are the same every day, like going into the bathroom to brush your teeth?
Yeah, this gets at this idea that psychologists have been looking at for a while, and that it seems that memory has been built by evolution to remember the gist of experiences rather than every excruciating detail. And the reason for that seems fairly obvious is that the excruciating details are not that useful to you. It's rather the gist of that experience, you know, the overall rules that then you can apply to future experiences that's more applicable to solving future problems or, you know, new experiences.
Do we know how the brain chooses which information it can let go of that may not be something that happens mm-hmm. sort of regularly, but, you know, how many days have you forgotten from elementary school?
Well, one of the probably the biggest factor is the what they call the emotional valence of the experience. A lot of study has been done this area of the brain called the amygdala, which seems to be sort of the emotional center of the brain, which is a little oversimplification. But as far as memory is concerned, the amygdala plays a critical role in emotional memories. And it's the emotional memories that seem to be stored and reinforced in the strongest way in the brain. And I mean, it sort of makes sense. I mean, if you, you know, had a traumatic experience, that you would remember that for the future so that you could avoid it, if at all possible, if it was something that, you know, in the future could serve you. So, you know, if you had, you know, a car accident, and at a certain situation, say, you know, it was raining and you, you know, skidded across the water on the street, you would, next time you saw it raining, I mean, you might get scared. You might be even more cautious because you remember that experience, you know, from all the high emotion you experienced at the time. So it seems like memory is built to sort of bias towards those emotional memories.
Let's go on the phone now to Nancy in Plano. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having your guest, Annalee. I am fascinated with memory because I've always had a pretty good memory, although it has been deteriorating with age, I noticed. But compared to my husband, he cannot recall anything about his childhood, and I can recall a lot of things about my childhood, and I just cannot believe that he can't recall very much. And also, I had a experience the other day. I was at a restaurant where I had had an early, very early lunch, like 11 o'clock, and I was the only one, and it was this other lady, older woman, and we both, I noticed she was reading a guidebook that I had read, and I told her, I started making a conversation with her, we talked about it. Anyway, I ran into her again, and this has been like a couple of years, and I greeted her, and I told her, you remember me, you and I talked, here, we had lunch, and we just kind of had lunch by ourselves. There was no one else here. And she said, no, I don't recall. She said, I wish I had a memory like that. I do not recall at all. And I said, do you remember we talked about a diet, and you just gotten started on that diet. And I said, and you even told me you were a real estate agent for new homes. And she said, wow, yeah, that's true. She said, but I don't recall.
It is interesting. Thanks so much for your call, Nancy. Some people really do seem to have just remarkable ability to call things up and to bring them to mind, and other people are almost baffled by that ability.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there seems to be this huge amount of individual, you know, variability. I mean, I'm one of those people, I mean, like our caller's husband, I don't remember what I did 2 days ago. I mean, my memory is just horrible. I have to rely on my friends and family, you know, to tell me what I did a week ago.
It's always interesting to me, and this doesn't come up in the doc, so I don't know if you looked into it, but I don't have a great sense of direction, but I can remember if I have been to a place most mm-hmm. of the time. Something about being in a new place allows you to sort of, you know, quickly take the lay of the land and recall it.
Yeah, I think place is one of those really fascinating areas of memory, and it's not something we got to explore in detail in our 1 hour show. But you know, I have sometimes spatial experience where I can kind of remember how to get somewhere mm-hmm. if I've been there just once. And it turns out that spatial memory is one of these sort of more ancient areas. It's also in the hippocampus. They've studied it extensively in animals, particularly in rodents. But it's a very specific kind of memory that you can actually see how the brain remembers places. And there's actually a little spatial map that they can actually visualize happening in the brain, say, when a rat goes through a maze.
Most of us have at least a few memories where we say, it happened years ago. I remember it like it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. We may not remember it like it was yesterday. We may have really changed the details over time, and we just haven't felt them changing in the same way that a message changes when we play telephone.
That's right. Right. And this is something we kind of explore in our show about, you know, if you remember your first kiss. And we spoke to a lot of people in the public to tell us about their first kiss. And we like to use that example because, I mean, one thing, it's something everyone remembers, and they remember certain kinds of details. But if you think about it, you know, think about all the times people may have asked you about, you know, your first kiss or, you know, another kind of experience, maybe your first date or the time you met your spouse. And depending on how they ask the question, you may recall certain details or describe it differently every single time you tell the story. And over time, you know, maybe you remember those details better, you forget certain other things. So you can sort of start to see how your memory can start, you know, shifting its shape over time.
It is possible to come to remember something that never happened to us without intending to tell a lie.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Yeah, this is one of these scary things, isn't it? In our show, we explore this idea of a false memory, and it's something that psychologists have been studying for quite some time. But there are a number of techniques you can do to actually implant a false memory in people. And it's remarkably easy to do if you know what you're doing. And it's a little scary, but in our show, we have a scientist, Julia Shaw, who kind of corrals all the techniques from social psychology and has people do an imagination exercise about a false memory that they committed a crime. Now, at first, these people that were in her experiment were like, no way, I didn't do that. That's impossible. There's no way that I, you know, got into a fight with a friend or that the police, you know, were called or anything like that. And yet she told the exact same script to over 100 people, and over 70% of her participants over the course of her study came to believe that they committed a crime. Now, that seems just insane. But when you watch our show and you watch how she conducted her experiment, you can start to see how this is possible.
And it is interesting because, I mean, I was wondering a little bit about the ethics of that experiment. Mm-hmm. First of all, how does it work in the end? Are people told that this was all pretend and don't worry, you haven't
Yes.
committed a crime?
Yes. Fortunately, they were all debriefed and told that, you know, this was a totally fake, made up memory. It was not real. And, you know, they laughed and, you know, couldn't believe that they were fooled into believing that they did this. But yes.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting, though, because there seems to be some influence from peer pressure or just, you know, knowing mm-hmm. that people around you want you to believe this thing.
Right. And so, you know, one of the tools that she used was peer pressure and saying, you know, things like, we're going to do this imagination exercise. It works for most people. And if you do it right, you know, it'll work for you, too. So that's kind of a subtle, you know, indication of peer pressure that, you know, it works for everyone else. So why wouldn't it work for you? So when they engage in this imagination exercise, they think, well, I want to do it right. I want to be in this experiment and be a good participant. I hope, you know, want to make it work for me. And so this thing called, you know, positive reinforcement, you know, is another tool that she would use. So when they would start to, you know, describe details that might have happened, where they say, well, you know, I can, you know, maybe I was with that friend at the time. I can sort of, you know, maybe we were at this bar. We went to this bar a lot. She said, good. Starts to look, looks like it's coming back.
Hmm.
So, you know, reinforcing, you know, these positive ideas.
And might have happened is interesting. You know, you'd probably mm-hmm. have a harder time convincing people that they rode a unicorn on Mars.
Right, right. Yeah, so one of the things she would start with, you know, having them describe, well, you know, this is something that did occur, you know, how might have it occurred? You don't remember it. I see that you don't remember it, but tell me how it might have happened.
Hmm.
And what, you know, you see over time is what, you know, what could have been, you know, turns into what would have been, turns into what was. And that's something that Julia Shaw, you know, illustrates for us in her experiment.
So what does this suggest about how we should treat things like eyewitness testimony, even confessions in criminal trials?
Yeah, I think this is an area that people, you know, should really think about and pay attention to, because one of the facts that sort of blew us away when we were doing this research is that there have been several hundreds of now cases that have been overturned with DNA evidence, people that were falsely convicted. And when you look at what, you know, what happened in their cases, it turns out over 3/4 of those cases that have been overturned with DNA evidence now were because of false eyewitness testimony.
Wow.
And that's a scary thing to think about, that the courts, you know, rely on eyewitness testimony to a degree, you know, that puts innocent people in jail. And, you know, it would stand to reason that there are still thousands of people, you know, in jail now because of false eyewitness testimony.
And presumably eyewitnesses don't mean to lie. They think they're remembering correctly.
That's right. That's right. And, this is something that over the past recent decades, because of the work of folks like Elizabeth Loftus, that has gotten better. But there's still a long way to go because the way that eyewitnesses were treated, even just a few years ago, would reinforce, you know, false beliefs. So they would bring in a witness and, you know, show them a lineup. They would take a look and say, is it any one of these people? And they say, well, no, I'm not sure. I mean, maybe number three kind of looks like the guy. I don't know. And then, you know, they say, well, are you sure? I'm like, no. Okay, well, if that person wasn't sure, they're not going to bring that person into court. And so they would bring them back again to see the same lineup. And then at that point, now number three is more familiar because they did come and see the lineup before. And over, you know, maybe three visits, now the person's, well, yeah, it could be number three. And then they would only put them on the stand, you know, if they were sure. So it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, the way that the, you know, court system would work.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Helen on the line in Louisville. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I was wondering if your guest had any knowledge on whether humans used to have the ability to remember things better, like short and long term, but perhaps we lost that ability because of evolution and now we don't need to.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And there has been a little bit of work that I know about to suggest that. This idea that maybe, you know, memory's flaws might actually, you know, be our friends in a way, might actually serve us. There's been some work of people with brain damage and testing their memories. And for some reason, their memories on certain kinds of tasks are actually better than normal people after they've had the brain damage. And that doesn't seem to make any sense. I mean, why would an injured brain suddenly remember certain kinds of things better than regular people? And that would seem to suggest that our memories might be built to forget for a reason. So I think that you know, gets at that idea.
What would they be better at than people without damaged brains?
So this particular you know, studies that I was thinking about from Dan Schachter has reviewed these studies from Harvard. They would be able to remember like lists of words and word associations better than regular people. After they've gotten the brain damage.
My guest is writer and director Annalise Strachan. Her NOVA documentary, Memory Hackers, airs tonight at 8 on KERA television. If you want to join this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Filmmaker Annalise Strachan is here. She wrote and directed the NOVA documentary Memory Hackers that airs tonight on KERA television. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. Annalise, many of us can imagine the benefits of improved memory skills, right? Who wouldn't want to never forget important things? On the other hand, most of us have experienced at least a couple of things in our lives that we wish we could forget. Mm-hmm. What kind of progress has been made towards selectively erasing traumatic memory?
This is such an amazing area of research that's going on right now, and it's something that we feature in our show. This idea about reconsolidation, it's a new area to actually rewrite memories when you recall them. And if scientists are now trying to harness that to see if they can selectively, you know, pick out certain memories that you might want to forget, such as a traumatic experience, and go back and erase them. And there's a scientist in Amsterdam, Meryl Kint, that we spoke to, who can do just that. And she has made progress in a variety of disorders, in particular phobias. She's taken people with spider phobia and exposed them to, you know, a tarantula to reignite their fear of spiders, which, of course, they're terrified. But when she reminds them of their spider fear, she, you know, has a little trick based on this biological research, which is to give them a drug right when they're recalling the memory that disrupts the brain when it's reestablishing those connections for the fear part of the memory. And what you're able to see 24 hours later is what appeared to us essentially a miracle. I mean, this is something that we watched happen on camera right before our eyes. A man who came in completely terrified of spiders, you know, a muscular, strong, tough-looking guy. And when he saw the tarantula, he just panicked. And the next day he comes in, sees the tarantula, and within 5 minutes is petting the spider. I mean, it is amazing. And she's done this work now with dozens of people and has had a lot of success. She's moving on to other types of phobias, anxiety disorders, and now trying to work with PTSD. And it is hopeful. It is hopeful area of research.
That scene really is extraordinary, like worth the time that you spend watching the entire documentary just for that. What about this, though? I was wondering if there might be a way to redirect. I mean, you'd have to think about the ethics of this, but there are people who have, like, not exactly memories, but prejudices that disrupt mm-hmm. their lives and certainly are disruptive to other people around them. Could the same ideas be applied to something like racial bias?
I mean, I don't see why not. I think the challenge, of course, is trying to, you know, come up with a better definition of, you know, things like that racial bias or other kinds of detrimental prejudices, and then trying to figure out a way to localize that in the brain. I mean, that's the big challenge for scientists that work in this area, coming up with definitions and then trying to, you know, find a biology to associate with those complicated ideas. That's very tough. And for someone like, you know, going way back in time, like with Eric Kandel back in the 50s and 60s, the idea that memory could be in the brain somehow, like in a particular place and have a particular physical representation, that in itself was revolutionary. So now, you know, fast forward all these decades, and now we're at the point where we can, you know, think about specific memories, like where they are in the brain, what parts are in, you know, different parts of the brain, the emotional part, the smell part, the visual part. You know, we're starting to be able to localize sort of vague aspects of particular memories. I think there's a ways to go before we can do something like racial prejudice, which has so many different components. But I don't think it's impossible.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jeff on the line in Plano. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. I was wondering what you think, what the research has shown as far as dreaming or rapid eye movement stage of sleep. As I understood that that was the time when memories would be filed, and you're kind of watching it during, I guess, the dream. You're even seeing irrelevant stuff from earlier in the day. Is that have there been enough research on that to show that that's it's important to get that amount of, you know, that kind of sleep?
What do you know about that, Emily?
Well, actually, this was a big area that was a tough area for us to decide when we were first coming up with our, you know, with our show. We only had an hour, and it would be easy to do 6 hours about memory. And you could do, you know, multiple hours on sleep and memory alone. Sleep and memory is a huge area of research. And when people ask me, you know, oh, you've done, you know, all this research about memory, what can I do to make my memory better? The number one thing to tell people is sleep. There's been a huge amount of research about how sleep improves your memory, and there's been literally thousands of experiments showing that to be the case. Even after a nap sometimes improves your performance on, you know, certain kinds of tests, and it appears that your memories help get consolidated or kind of filed away in your brain as you're sleeping. And it might be the case that sleep, its primary purpose from evolution might be to help us learn and function in the daytime.
I know this is not the focus of the doc, but so much memory research starts with animals. And until very recently, humans haven't really conceived of more than a handful of animals as having very much intelligence at all.
Yeah, that's right. And it's kind of amazing to think that when you actually look at, you know, animals on, you know, the biological level and the level of cells, how similar we are. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find any differences if you just looked at, you know, a neuron of a rat versus a neuron of a human. The basic mechanisms that are in a rat, that are in a sea slug, I mean, they underlie for all of us. And, you know, that speaks volumes about evolution and about biology and how we work.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Don on the line in Saginaw. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have a memory that I've carried around with me since I was the age of 2 or 3. Actually, I've had several memories, but a few years ago, I was able to test my memory by revisiting a place that I had seen at the age of two or three and had not seen in the interim. It was in the Garden of the Gods on the highest suspension bridge in the world over the Royal Gorge. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But my memory was from sitting on my father's shoulder and looking straight down and seeing the train tracks and the island and the river that runs through the Royal Gorge. So I wanted to test my memory, and just by chance, through business, I was able to revisit the place. And I could have drawn a picture of it, but I didn't. I was just wanted to check my own memory. So I walked out onto the bridge and looked straight down, and it was exactly the way I had remembered it.
Don, thank you so much for your call. Annalie, it does seem that some of those earliest memories we have are really intense, and are they likely to be accurate later on?
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating thing to think about. Just how accurate are these memories that you hold so dear, these early memories? And in the course of doing research of this show, I mean, I came to doubt pretty much all of my early childhood memories. In fact, there's only one that I can be sure of, and I had to kind of keep moving the age forward until age five. These memories that I thought I had were age three. I'm like, not sure if that's really true. You know, what happens over time is that people tell us stories about ourselves, and they become incorporated into your personal narrative. I remember, you know, from my own experience, I have a little brother 6 years younger, and my older brother and I would always tell him stories about his childhood. And then he would come to tell us in his teenage years that those were his memories. And, you know, we told him, no, we told you that. You can't have a memory. You were only like two or one. But yeah, I think, I mean, there's definitely a case to be made that the vividness and these emotional experiences when you're young will be, you know, strong memories in the brain. We know there's biological evidence of that. And at the same time, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that these things are malleable and become very different over time from the suggestions of others, the storytelling, and the context that, you know, you describe them.
It's always so interesting within families when, you know, a number of people were present for the same event and one person remembers it and another person doesn't remember it. And then there's this question of like, who's right, who's wrong, who's making things up?
Right. Exactly. No, there was when we spoke to, you know, people in the public, we sort of asked a lot of basic questions about their memories. One of these elements of our show, just talking to regular folks, not just scientists. And one person in particular had a memory of, you know, adding, I think it was cayenne pepper to her brother's, you know, meal. And, you know, she found out later that it was actually her sister that, you know, did that trick. But she had told the story her whole life that she was the one that did it. You know, yeah, it's amazing, I think, to think how many of our memories might not be true.
It is interesting the way that brain chemicals play into recording of memories. And I guess adrenaline is a big one that, you know, when it's surging through our systems, we're more likely to remember what's going on.
That's right. Yeah. And one of the most studied areas of memory are these emotional memories that involve that system, that involve adrenaline. And adrenaline and, you know, the hormones that come from the amygdala seem to reinforce the connections between the emotional parts of the brain and elsewhere. Yeah, and that's definitely the case.
Is there a lot of research into drugs that might help us remember better when we're studying or doing a task that, you know, we want to recall?
Yes, there is lots of research in this area, and in particular, a lot of people, when they, you know, think about how do I make my memory better, they're thinking about things like, you know, how can I do better on a test for school, or, you know, remember facts, or remember where I put the keys, or if I turned off the stove, and a lot of that research is sort of in this area of mnemonics, which is not featured in our show, but it is sort of its own huge beast of research. And there are all kinds of techniques you can use to, you know, improve your memory that way.
Was it actually hard? You know, you mentioned that, you know, once you start getting into this, you could do easily six specials. How did you make decisions about, okay, this is where we're going to start and end this particular film?
I think, yeah, that was a difficult choice. And, you know, there's this huge field of memory search. And like I mentioned, there were areas that we didn't even really get to touch on, like sleep. Like mnemonics, you know, these memory athletes, for example, that, you know, they make careers out of memorizing thousands of digits or stacks of cards, and how to improve your memory maybe with drugs. I mean, these are areas that are not prominently featured in our film. But I think what we started was with a very basic question, which is, you know, how does my memory work? This sort of big general question of, like, what is memory? How does it work? And once you kind of ask that basic question, where does that lead you? And, you know, the first answers start to come from folks like Eric Kandel, who looked at a basic mechanism for how memory works in the brain. And once you find those kind of basic mechanisms, they start to take you down a path of, like, well, wait, if we know this, then maybe we can actually change memory. Maybe we can manipulate it. And for us, that was a fascinating question to explore. And that's something we chose to go with in the film, to go with looking into how we might be able to manipulate memories.
Evolution moves much more slowly than culture, of course. But I wonder if, just in surveying the landscape, if you looked into these questions people have now about whether the way we outsource our memories with photography and with the things that are on our phones and with even the technology of reading and writing is affecting how and what we can remember.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that the more that we sort of, you know, outsource our memories, the less that we have to, you know, rely upon our own brains to recall the information, because it's just there. Why bother? Why make the effort? And there has been some research in this area. I'm not terribly familiar with it, but what I do know is that we are becoming better at knowing how to find the information, rather than knowing the information itself, which initially you may think is a bad thing. You may think, oh, well, if I'm now outsourcing, you know, a map of, you know, Chicago, I don't need to know how to drive anywhere anymore. I can just Google it. It may seem like that's a bad thing. But if you think about it, it also kind of frees us up to sort of think more deeply and be able to ask bigger and better questions, and connect bigger ideas about information, rather than just kind of wasting a lot of space on just the information and the details alone. And there's some, you know, research that suggests that, you know, this is not necessarily a bad thing, outsourcing kind of all the detail.
I'm so glad you went to think more deeply and not like more time for BuzzFeed or something.
Right.
Like that.
Right. Yeah. I'm not so afraid anymore. I mean, initially when I was doing this research, I was worried about that too. All you have to do is Google it. You don't need to know anything anymore. But it doesn't seem to be like this bad thing. It actually seems to be connected with these ideas that, you know, evolution sort of built our brains this way for a reason. You don't need to know every excruciating detail. You're actually meant to be creative and have a flexible memory, because a flexible memory enables you to pull, sort of recombine elements of your past to better serve your future. And they don't have to be totally accurate. They just need to be accurate enough.
Annalise Strachan wrote and directed the Nova documentary Memory Hackers. You can see it on KERA television tonight at 8. Annalise, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones this hour from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.